is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jim Blair, Chair of the University Assembly, and it is 4:32, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Assembly to order. We do have some people that we're expecting to pop in shortly, but for the sake of time, we need to get started, and we do have a quorum present. I would note for our guests, welcome. We'll introduce you more formally when we get to that part of the agenda, but we'd also like to welcome the Cornell Daily Sun, and we have some visitors from the Judicial Administrator's Office.
Judicial Codes
Counselor's Office. Welcome, welcome. Are there any late additions to the agenda? Hearing none, then approval of the minutes from November 4th, 2014. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
So moved. A second from Professor Lowe. Are there any additions or changes to the minutes? Hearing none, I ask unanimous consent to approve the minutes of November 4th. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the minutes of November 4th are approved. Next on the agenda are committee updates. Executive Vice Chair, Mr. Battaglia.
Two things to report from the Executive Committee. First off, Dr. Corson Reichert has been pushed from this meeting. She'll be now coming to our January 26th meeting.
That was 27th.
27th, pardon me. That was due to a scheduling conflict. We will be having her as well as other representatives from Gannett at that time. Also, from the CWC, we were told that they are making and designing a domestic violence awareness shirt that is supposed to be purple or lavender, and Cora Best is currently not available to do so. We were wondering if there was someone who would, because it does need to be done by the 4th, and the chair of the CWC, Cora Best, is out of town until the 3rd. If there's any progress with that, anyone from the CWC could talk to me after. I'd appreciate it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Battaglia. Any questions for the exec? I believe we also have a, we're working on a, or the CWC is also working on a logo for,
Open Hearts.
Yeah, Open Hearts, Open Minds, and perhaps we'll hear more about that in a little bit. Campus Infrastructure Committee, Mr. LaSalle.
We have not had a meeting, but we did have attendance. We did not get a report back on how the sustainability summit went. I did attend a meeting yesterday also with Greg Easy on the Transportation Task Force that started up, so we're engaged in that. And then I have a meeting as a liaison to the campus planning, and that's going to happen on December 4th.
Regarding the Transportation Task Force, you are now formally appointed as a member?
Correct.
Awesome. Regarding the Sustainability Summit, I was there for the entire summit. It was an excellent morning, very well done, very well organized, the information very helpful, and I think Professor Hatch will, some of the things he'll talk to us later about kind of stem from some things that happened at that meeting, were presented at that meeting. Questions for the CIC? Very well. Campus Welfare Committee, is Mazelle Foreman here? Oh, welcome, welcome. Can you please give us an update on the CWC?
Yeah, I'm just going to give Cora's update here. So we had our meeting 2 weeks ago on Tuesday. Chair and one member were in attendance at that meeting, so there has been a problem consistently with attendance and turnout in those meetings. We are conducting polling to find out whether a new monthly meeting schedule will suit the current members of the committee better. We did discuss the Orsal report at that meeting, and we'll continue this discussion in the spring. The chair will speak this week with UDO Renee Alexander about new plans for the Towards New Destinations initiative, and in the spring, the committee will revisit the campus smoking policy per UASF request.
Thank you. Questions for the CWC? Moselle, do you know there's a T-shirt we're decorating in support of domestic violence from the Student Assembly? Cora had agreed to take that on, but I know she's out today, tomorrow, Do you know if somebody else has picked that up? Because I know our T-shirt is due the 4th.
I do not know.
Could you? Can you please help us check on that?
I will. Yes.
Let us know if we, or especially Matt Battaglia, if we have to work something in the background. And I'll make sure that I send you a copy of the email. Cogent Judicial Committee, Professor Wayne.
So we met and we went over the group misconduct website with Travis Asper, the associate dean, and we learned how the website was set up, who owned the website, and what went into putting somebody on the website, what distinguished an individual from the group. We also met with Mary Beth Grant, the judicial administrator, and she went over policy 6.4 with us and the mechanics of policy 6.4. And it's something that is continually being looked at, and she asked us for some of our suggestions, thoughts, and comments. And we started talking about the limited advance notice and whether the CJC should take that on and give it to the space committee. And there wasn't agreement among ourselves what we should do. We decided to have another meeting this coming Friday where Joseph Fridman will be presiding since I'll be out of town. And since that time, there's been an email exchange between different people to considering considering how strongly we should say that they're we're not interested in
the campus code.
In the campus code.
Welcome, Chief Zona. Please have a seat. We got a seat for you over here. You can't hide. You're our guest this evening. Is that everything, Professor Wayne?
We have another meeting this Friday at 2:30. Should anybody be interested? I'm not sure exactly where the meeting is.
We'll confirm that. I believe it is. Yes, it is in PSB 401.
This room.
Yeah, this room. I would say that obviously you'll let us know how it goes after the meeting, whether you come to a conclusion or not. But if I understand you correctly, it is your belief at the moment that the CJC does not believe that limited advance notice should be addressed in the campus code at this time.
At this moment, yes.
Okay. Well, then we wait to hear the results of your December 5th meeting. You hope to wrap it up at that meeting, or?
I imagine it will be.
Okay. Questions for the CJC? Then we're going to turn to business of the day, and we'd like to welcome Vice President Opperman, Vice President Murphy, and Chief Zoner, and for introductions, Ms. Odessa.
Yes. As you all probably already know, these wonderful have come to join us this evening, and I'm very pleased to introduce Mary Opperman, our Vice President of Human Resources and Student Services, and Judy Murphy, our Vice President of Student and Academic Services. And both are here today as our co-chairs of the Council on Sexual Violence Prevention. And the Council is also comprised of staff, faculty members, students, as well as local service providers. And I wanted to welcome Chief Zoner as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies, the floor is yours. I don't know what was forwarded to you or not as to the interest of the general members or whether you had something you had previously prepared.
I don't know that I have a notion of a particular question, but I think what we could do is just give a very basic framework of what we are doing in the Council of Sexual Violence Prevention. There are members of the Council who are here in the room. How it is connected to policy 6.4, and then let's have a conversation. That's what would make sense, I think, if there are issues or questions or concerns that members of the UA might have.
absolutely ideal. We're looking to see. I don't think we've met with you in this role, and it's a relatively new group at Cornell, though, you know, it's been around, it's not that new, but I think we're interested in how you think things are going, what you're set up, where you're heading, and of course how we might be able to help with where you want to take it. And before I actually turn the floor over to you, I'd like to recognize Alan Mittman is here with us tonight. He's an employee trustee, but he's also one of the experts on Policy 6.4, and those of you who have been in the Assembly more than a year will know that he was instrumental in the Title IX discussions we had a year or two ago in the implementation of Policy 6.4. So welcome, Alan. And Vice President Murphy and Opperman, the floor is yours.
Well, let me maybe just begin with some introductory words and ask Mary to augment them. And we'll go from there. So to your point, Jim, the university's addressing the issue of sexual violence is not a new issue. It's been something that we've actually been engaged in for decades. One of our own faculty, Andrea Harris, is really one of the leaders in the nation in addressing matters of sexual violence and creating a campus-based community, a campus-based effort here on the campus 25 years ago. From her work and a group that was known as the CARE group, from the outgrowth of the victim advocate position held by Nina Cummings, that has been in place for as long as I've been Vice President for over 20 years. But following your colleague letter by the Office of Civil Rights in 2011, I think every campus found itself reviewing its own policies and procedures for addressing matters of sexual harassment and sexual violence in our communities, and the expectations now, in some cases, the obligations that are placed upon us as institutions of higher education in addressing matters of sexual violence. I should add that although the council doesn't have a formal charge, the issue of sexual violence and domestic violence in light of this weekend's tragedies here in Ithaca, and as you read in any of the national discourse, domestic violence is of the family of sexual violence. And so I think we all want to be spending some time to be thinking about where we can be more explicit about that reference. In fact, I know our colleagues who are working on the SHARE website, which is one of the early initiatives that came out of our work together, have actually been doing some work with some FAQs related to matters of domestic violence and appropriate reference. As you already alluded, a group of staff led by Annette Chappelle-Williams together with Mary Beth Grant, Alan Bittman, and Anita Brenner spent a lot of time looking at overarching policy around sexual violence when the expectations placed upon campus communities that we need to treat matters of sexual violence under the standard of evidence, the preponderance of evidence. Where this group got involved early on, it was clear that we needed to be able to move the adjudication of matters of sexual violence out of the campus code and put it under policy 6.4. So there's a whole competition that had on that level, and it sounds like some of that's already happened with Mary Beth and others. I think what our interest was in the creation of the Council on Sexual Violence Prevention was an outgrowth of our learning from our council on alcohol and other drugs, on mental health and welfare, on hazing prevention. There has been value for us as a campus community to gather faculty, staff, students, community members as appropriate, and also here alumni, to think collectively about what is it we need to be doing in the prevention, intervention, and response continuum. That's really been the frame of our work. In concert with much of what we're doing in other areas, we're trying to think about the overarching culture, broad culture as well as culture on campus. What can we be doing in the area of education and outreach? How do we monitor what's going on here? How do we promote health-seeking behavior and reporting? And part of that is having confidence, having the community have confidence that when reporting occurs, a process will flow from that. How do we provide a coordinated support for the victims or survivors, but they're necessarily described as individuals. There are some environmental issues in terms of physical safety and environmental safety of the campus, and of course we have our obligation to what we must do to keep them close to that. So that's kind of a big overarching charge of the council. We spent much of the first year focused on our obligation about education for our newest members of the community, undergraduate, graduate students, and new faculty and staff. Our students, by the way, would speak about it, which they brought in a year ago, in January, as a pilot, and that was successful enough that we took that up and used that for our first year students and advanced students this fall. We had informational programs for all of our graduate special students, and Mary talked about the very good work coming out of Wall Park and her colleagues to create a new educational program for faculty and staff and entitled Building of Culture and Respect. So much of our focus this past year was on getting that education program, trying to figure out in our decentralized environment how do we make sure people are indeed educated. We're also trying to and have been cataloging the many efforts that are underway for education of a continuing nature that's even more dispersed than it is in the student world than it is around first year students. But that's both an obligation that sits out there for us, but also what we know to be a desire. Just because you deliver a message once of orientation doesn't mean that it's internalized and that or will act on the information that they're provided. So there's work that's going on in the residential communities and required, some of it led by students, and I'll speak about that in just a minute because I think it's important for students, especially being at the forefront of this, but not having them feel the sole obligation. Because while the culture, particularly in the student world, is led by students, they need to have the support, guidance, occasional wisdom, from the administration and the faculty in this area. But I also know that as the vice president at age 63, if I'm the one crafting the messages to current students, there's going to be a disconnect. So we really have to find a way to have the students in a leadership role. This fall, I would just include my comments. I think we had a very engaging and interesting presentation at our council meeting about a month ago from a faculty member at Yale by the name of Melanie Boyd, who is also now serving in the administrative role. And she spent her whole session talking about the work that they're beginning to do at Yale to move the conversation away from how do we prevent rape from happening, how do we prevent sexual violence from happening, to a conversation about what is the culture on the campus we want to have in place in which healthy sexual relationships occur. And she talked about why that kind of reframing of the conversation is so critical, how that's how you can get it from culture change, what is the staffing that they're doing, and it's, I think, prompted many of us to think about how might that affect what we do here on the campus. So on Thursday this week, when we have our next council meeting, we will be thinking of two topics. One is to have some time among the council members to do some briefing about that, because the presentation basically filled the whole session. We had some Q&A, but I think some people are spending a lot of time thinking about it, others have wanted to go back to it. The second topic we will be talking about, which you've seen a lot in the national media, about what is the definition of consent. So consent is, is either the absence of no or the presence of yes, to be simplifying that issue. And now the state of California has mandated it has to be
yes.
The presence of yes, not the absence of no. And there's work going on in New York, some obligations upon the SUNY system that may actually end up framing what will be legislation that affects private institutions. And that's a topic that most of us as administrators don't feel comfortable just deciding for ourselves what ought to be the definition. So we want to have a conversation among the council. And then depending upon the level of significance of the change about what currently exists versus what it may come, what kind of community conversation do we have to be on the council. We need, if you want to start that, we want to keep folks here closer to the topic and our own information. So I think that's a fairly quick overview. As to your question, Jim, of how you can help, I think it's know, as a part of the shared governance system, making sure that you're aware of the minutes for the Council of Central Balance Protection of Public Minutes. They sit out on the Gannett website. This is one of the topics of concerns, and so I encourage any and all to make themselves aware of that. And as you hear issues, make sure that obviously the safety issue gets tapped immediately. If it's of an educational nature, the missionary and I are aware of that. And if we find we're certainly we're not having engagement, we'd love to reach out to you. But I don't think that's been an issue for the topic today.
No, I mean, maybe we can open it up and have some questions and we'll follow through on that. But I was going to talk a little bit about the impact that my board's presentation had. It was really a very eye-opening way of thinking about sexual pleasure and the some of the issues that are emerging and what she's learning in both the research and what she's doing at Yale. I found it really helpful. She frames sexual experiences on a very different continuum of consensual and welcome, consensual and unwelcome, and not consensual. And she framed how the many of the issues that create a lot of the of facts are in the consensual but unwelcome category. So perhaps an encounter begins as consensual and welcome, but then facts during that encounter turn unwelcome, and that those experiences are the most complex for the parties to navigate. So I just found her whole framing of the issue of culture really helpful in to the study goal with the idea of actually changing things for the better. The other thing I was just going to mention is that we're faced with, I have to say that I'm happy to see these issues brought to light. They're not new. They have emerged at other times and simply not stayed in the forefront long enough for changes to occur. We are, and so the dear colleague brought in 2011 brought forward issues that many of us have known were present in our culture, not just on the Earth, but not just on the culture, for many, many, many decades. But what we are now faced with is the responsibility to act in compliance with regulations, as well as engage our community in how we actually respond and make changes in our culture. And we have to do those at the same time. And sometimes that that bookending, if you will, feels like.
Just a second, Professor. Before we get to Professor Wayne's question, on behalf of the Assembly, I think we have one concern that I want to raise. I don't know that you have an answer to, but I know that you'll be aware of it. The start of the year, there were chalk drawings around the campus, kill rapists, and that caught my personal attention and some others, and I looked into it, and it was actually hard to pull out information as to who, what, when, and there was this, and then there were some articles in the Sun, which I know we emailed about briefly, indicating, dissatisfaction. As we've kind of looked at it informally, I know how serious CUPD and others treat these things when an allegation is made. I absolutely know. And I know from my personal experience prior to coming to Cornell, where I led groups as many as 1,500, so it isn't new. But I've experienced these issues very firsthand. And if the report upon initial investigation carries credence, things begin to become drawn out. Title IX, I believe, requires 30 days. But this was my read, and some of this, there's this culture of acceptance here, this unacceptable culture. I don't believe it, but what I do believe is we aren't anywhere near adjudicating allegations within 30 days. Or 60. It's probably more like 6 months or longer. I don't know. And that leads to this perception of culture because nothing's been done. So the institution must be, it's completely false, and yet because you can't talk about everything, because you can't share everything. So if I can ask, what is our nominal actual timeline for these cases? How quickly are we actually getting them done?
I think Mary Beth Grant could probably be better to that if she were here. But the investigation needs to be completed in 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that means your fact gathering and being ready to sort of try to wrap things up. Now, given that there are many processes that, and Alan speaks to this too, there are different processes that happen after the investigation has finished. There are opportunities still for appeals and other measures, and there may be a timeliness factor of getting people present to have meetings with them. That tends to push things out. And correct me if I'm wrong, Alan, I don't know what's coming here to you, but Mary Beth is saying in her student seat, it seems like it's around 6 months is what they're looking at right now. But I don't
know.
In the policy, it does say 60 days for the investigation, and at least as far as the appeals have come to me, with one exception, we have been under at or a day or two over 60 days. There's one phrase that's been taken to that. Then there's a formal time in which, let's say, if you find against, you find for the complainant against the respondent, the respondent by policy has X number of days in which that person can respond, that's 10. And then the complainant has X number of days to which they can provide a response, as well as sort of goes to the review board. So it's another 10 days. Now you've added 20 days. Then it goes to the review board, and the review board, which is made up of three faculty, has a defined time. I think it might be at least a couple of weeks. Then there's a defined time for either side to appeal. First one, then typically the other. Then it comes to me, and I'm supposed to be mine in 30 days. So you can, you know, even if everybody's doing it just as we lay it out, you will find it belonging. I think it is fair to say that one of the things that we've observed in Title IX, both the Title IX coordinators and the executive group, is that we are short on investigation. Yeah. Given the number, and so the good news is the number of cases, and again, Mary Beth will have you read it better than I do, off the top of my head. The number of cases coming forward from before 2011 to now is measurably different. I mean, we were going from a half dozen to 20 to a couple dozen. And with not a lot of increase in the staff. And these cases in particular are a lot more complicated to investigate than a bike violation. They're witnesses, they're sensitive. And so I think one of our challenges, and Mary and I have talked about this, is that in both our administrative roles, as well as our co-chairs of the council, working with the Title IX coordinators, is trying to figure out how is it that we can put forth an understanding of what is the need to increase our investigative staff, so that they can move along in a more timely fashion. Because whether you're the complainant or the respondent, during that time period while the investigation and the whole adjudication is happening, it's very difficult. Very, very difficult.
Yeah. What I have seen, so I know I speak for a majority of assembly members when we say we need to find ways to do this fairly and properly and speed it up. That will help at some level. It will never be as short as people would want it, and it's difficult. And I know that firsthand. It's just messy. But some things that I've seen be effective in other organizations deal with. At a certain point, you've made an initial determination of guilt, and there's the appeal process that follows. During the appeal process, if they're like in the same class, you know, if not before, do we allow them to, one of the students to withdraw without fees, get them in a different section? If it's an office issue, you know, are there smart ways to take care of some of the, you know, some of this, the things that people really notice over 6 months? That's a whole semester. that's a lot of class time, a lot of lab time or office time.
Are you obliged to do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got a hostile environment that's been created, you're obliged. I will say, in other cases, it can be very difficult. So you have teammates, as an example, in which there's an allegation of a sexual violence, one to another. And while the investigation is going on, you're not guilty until you're not guilty until you're proven innocent. You're innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there is a potential for a hostile environment. So we try as best as we can to figure out how you accommodate that. But if you're on the same team with the same coach, sometimes it can be really difficult.
Yeah.
So if they're in housing, we'll move the housing. And we have certainly done that. We won't, unless we think there's a threat to the community, we won't kick that student out of housing per se, but we may well move them out of the immediate housing environment.
Okay.
And I'm not a student.
Well, it's the same thing, and I think it's important to just acknowledge it is a long time. It's very stressful. There are parties, especially when the parties have so many children to do. Finding interim measures that are acceptable is not actually as easy as it seems like it would be. And I think you're right that moving swiftly but fairly and thoroughly is the goal. And we have to do that and keep in mind that there are certain things we're now, certain ways in which we are required to investigate by regulation with time frames and steps in it. So to say, it doesn't make the concern.
I want to compliment you and the university for the SHARE website. It's actually very well done. The information is easy to find and pretty concise. I did take HR 200 yesterday. I had some feedback for it. Who should I send that to? To Alan?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Professor Wayne, you had a question.
My wife and I were talking about the say that. And also we could see with the notary public at the bottom of the bed. And short of that, it seems honestly to be a ridiculous place to try to legislate what you say you call consensual but unwanted that of all the different places to prevent the worst of crimes. I think that's the worst possible method of trying to prevent. I can't picture anything good.
So when
productive.
When I was much younger, and we were trying to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, there was a person who said to us, you cannot legislate changes in attitude. And I actually disagreed then that there wasn't a place for clear expectations. And I still think that's true, but to your point, the purpose of this conversation for an affirmative consent has much to do with trying to get parties, I'm going to go back a little bit to the culture here, to get parties to be sure they're on the same page. And I think that's actually a very good effort. Whether or not there is a way to legislate that so that it will change culture, I don't know. But the point of it is to try to get parties who are either about to or in the midst of a very intimate relationship or act to be sure that they actually are on the same page. The absence of no doesn't do the same thing. And so I don't know how you write that or say that, but that's the point behind it.
I have a question about that.
Just a second. Juliana?
Yeah, thank you, Mary. I completely agree with your sentiments there, and I do think that it's important to also recognize all the student efforts that I really do think tackle those issues that we necessarily can't legislate, but really change the culture for students. It is very important. I just had two quick questions, and thank you so much for coming out today. Even though I wasn't at the Shares meeting about Yale, it does seem like there are positive responses all around about the program that they're using. Is there any plans in the future to kind of mimic or do a spin-off of their program? If so, could you expand on that? And then further, I know that Speak About It was confirmed for this fall, which is very exciting. But I was also wondering if Cher had a vision for the future for Speak About It, as well as the programming in January for transfers. And I'd love to hear about that as well. So thank you so much.
So in response to your first question, there's been a group of staff, mainly from the Good Student Excellence Service, but not entirely, Kathy's been part of the conversation and Mary Beth and others, that have been spending a lot of time thinking about what Dr. Boyd shared with us. And they are pulling together some recommendations about what we might do. To the extent that they come with a significant budget in the current budget environment that will end, I think it will prompt us to say, well, how do we accomplish those goals, but keeping our heads in a different way? It is a very active conversation, and I actually just started adopting it in my inbox that committee. I have not read it, but I've been aware of this conversation, and I'm frankly thrilled that we've had a group taking it very seriously. I think we'll have to, we know we're in a tough budget environment, we know we have investigation pressures as well. So if this becomes an area that we have to invest in, what are we going to stop doing elsewhere in the division or elsewhere because we deem this to be a higher priority and that's an end that we have. But, coming out of this, I think, weekly meeting that this group has been having, are there things that we could start sooner than later that don't yet have large budget pieces to begin to move the discussion? To the point about the Speak About It program, which we do hire a group from outside to put this program on, and there's no concern about it continuing in the fall. The reason that the orientation staff chose not to do it this spring were for two reasons. One, our cohort of students entering the spring was quite small, 100-ish, and it did not seem to be a wise cost and cost benefit. It's an important set of messages, but are there different ways we could do that? And in fact, I think what the team is putting together a discussion for the January for the new students is trying to think about can they take pieces coming out of the discussion I just mentioned and what Dr. Boyd is telling us. And begin to, because this year they're all transfer students, so chances are they've had a basic education in their orientation because they were coming from school, so they had to have that. But we might begin to pilot some kind of conversations in a different way. So I think that, I haven't seen the structure of the program, but I think that's the intent. How they want to take the January and after May, they know more than I do. I think going forward about speaking about it, Juliana, the question will be, there will always need to be something at orientation on the topic. Whether it's to speak about it open per se, or does that get stale and we want to bring somebody else, or do we decide to train our own students in the same way we've done ordinary people that bring up the faculty program? I think it's something that we ask ourselves all the time in student academic services and student life. Because, ironically, when I began as vice president, we had a very active series of programs and orientation called Sex Assessment. And it was a whole set of programs around sexual behavior and consent and what college is about. And it was a very vibrant and vital program, I'd say, for about 6 or 8 years. And we ultimately discontinued it because students voted with their feet. They stopped coming. And I think it was because we didn't keep the program current. I mean, you guys change in the culture every 4 or 5 years. And so if you have a canned program that worked really well 5 years ago, you can assume 8 years later it's supposed to be relevant. So I would say, this will be a topic of conversation for subsequent councils, for the obligation within orientation and this orientation. What is the right program for us in 2015, 2020, 2025, and whether it's Speak About It or something else, I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, it's reassuring here that the vision is that it will hopefully always be a mainstay of orientation.
I think until we're in a culture where this is not an issue, and I can't imagine at this with a residentially based campus of 18 to 22 year olds primarily, where alcohol is present, we're not going to be in this position.
Thank you, Professor Booker.
In my experience of sort of campus life, I was part of two cultural changes. I was a member of the second class that included women at the college I attended. And as I was leaving, we also engaged in a conversation that later was implemented about whether or not we should have fraternal organizations like that. And in both cases, there's a major shift in the culture as a result. We're talking mainly about process when we talk about this issue. I mean, it's about adjudication, it's about informing people, getting people to talk about, you know, attacks that they have happened, things of that sort. But, you know, to what extent are we going to acknowledge some of the things, for instance, in the Rolling Stone article with CBA, or if we want to talk about Princeton, you know, one of our peers and the issues they had at Tiger Club. And, you know, I was in a fraternity as an undergraduate, and even though we may not want to acknowledge what it's like, you know, on a day-to-day basis in the house, if you're, you know, with the guys, guys are guys, and when you're together, you know, there's a chemistry. And I just wonder whether or not Cornell has enough courage, students as well as faculty, to think about one of the main cultural shifts that can be done on this campus is eliminating fraternal organizations. Now, most students will go, well, not in my fraternity house, but if there's one or two on campus in which that chemistry exists, the nice thing about that is that they are still poisoning the waters, and there's always a chance that even at a house that now might be clean in 5 years, because we know the culture of each fraternity house changes in 5 years, there'll be another, or a second, or a third, or fourth, or fifth. And to a certain extent, you know, if that conversation happens, I think it in and of itself might be significant. You know, why can't we just ask the question, should we close fraternities in the next 5 years? And then have the fraternity and give reasons why we should, and then have counterpoints to those arguments, and then come to a decision at the campus about whether or not this should occur. Because I can tell you on most campuses, between fraternity and alcohol, you know, you're talking about probably a majority of the cases. Not all of them, but they are actually a majority of significant cases on campus. And, you know, from students, I would like to hear from students, do we really need fraternities? Is the price that we pay for having them worth it?
Any thoughts?
God knows I have a lot of
questions. Okay. then perhaps...
I hope there's never a topic we can't discuss this law, because we're an educational institution. I happen to come to this from a very different perspective, and I will tell you on the four cases that I have seen, that I'm dealing with student cases, one of the four is good, three or not, which would be about representative of our population. About a quarter to 28% of our students, undergraduate students, are going to be. So, is there a higher risk? There's no question. There's a higher risk in athletics. There's a higher risk in Greek, both for alcohol and for other behavior. I think there also, what we know from a lot of our other research, which tells us, not us, but the research that Gallup just did, some of the greatest gains and outcomes can come from athletic teams and students in terms of engagement and leadership and active citizenship. So the question, so the position I've taken for 20 years, I won't be here, come to you, the topic can take a very different turn. The position I've taken is the founding values of these organizations had no part of it, and what is our ability to get them closer to the founding values? And some days I think we're making progress in a positive direction, and some days I'll be the first to say, as I beg to quote them in individual chapters, we are not. So I think for a campus of our size, not the size of Occidental or Western or Bates or Boeing, there is a role for them to play. But if they cannot find ways to be productive
enhancements to the educational environment, and they are only negative, then I would be the first one to say this from the board. I'm not there yet, because it's not even unselfish, it's really very personal, it's actually the American Vice President, what I recommend to the President, but I, as I weigh, I'm not at all negative, and therefore they must go. So you have to get to that point, absolutely. Now, your point, which is an important one, is you know, start the conversation to demonstrate that, and also before you have to, you find yourself there. And there, I would say, that's a conversation that the campus is ready to take on, you should take on.
And then the main you say that because of the UA, the Rolling Stone article, which
well,
reflected the view of the students in terms of how they view Greek life and how that actually affected their reporting process. I mean, in that particular case, it wasn't reported because the friends of the students with the victims actually were afraid that it would hurt their chances of getting into the social life of Greek life. And that's really important.
And I would say it's not just the Greek life. You know, to me, that was the saddest. So the saddest thing in that article was that it occurred at all.
Yeah.
But the second saddest thing was I'm not going to report it because of the reputation of the institution and our social credibility on the campus, whether it's in Greek or not, will be damaged and will be no credit.
I'm just trying to figure out a way to really engage students in conversation.
Let me interrupt this. We're now at a time. I know that one of you, if not both of you, have evening commitments, and so I need to end this conversation now for the sake of their schedule. But I know that there are at least two more questions, and I would ask you to send those to Rosemary Odessa. She'll coordinate with Susan Murphy and Vice President Opperman, and we'll get answers to the corporate body as you have them, but I need to get them to their next evolution. And so, thank you so very much for joining us tonight and updating us on your work.
Well, thank you for your interest, and I hope we can continue, you know, conversation even if we don't always agree or we have huge questions about what is this is all about. And this is a community discussion, and we'll only make progress if this is an active community.
Thank you so much.
Turn.
We're ready for you.
We now need to turn to the next item, the annual Cornell University Police Department update and clear act statistics. And to do that, the head of the CU Police Department, our good friend, Kathy Sommer. While we're bringing this up, Kathy, if you want to give some opening remarks or anything like that.
I'm just going to invite people to reload and enjoy this. Part of the issue with presenting on this is that some of you have heard this before, so it may feel like you've seen it all before, and some of you may not have heard any of it, and all is important, and some of it has changed. So, as with any legislation, I try to move through it as quickly as possible and try to keep it from being dry. Yep. But I apologize because a lot of it's dry. But I did try to put some pretty pictures and graphs so that we can ask and raise questions. I can try to simplify some things. One thing I will share is that I did not bring hard copies with me, but on our website at www.cu.cornell.edu, there is you can find a PDF copy of every current year's clear statistics, and all the statistics go back 3 years from the December date of the calendar year. We don't do the clear statistics by law. We have to do them for the calendar year, not the fiscal year. So I don't have any for 2014 yet. I have some rough two dates that I can share with you. So if you had it,
well, it's scanned, and now I just open it. You're going to the guy who
doesn't.
I think it's open somehow.
I can start by talking. This is the slide. Most of this graph has to begin with. And so just so everybody's aware, the Gene Clear Disclosure of Campus Security Policy and Campus Crime Statistics Act was originated as a landmark federal case back in the late 80s, early 90s, and has gone through several transgressions. It was originally known as the Campus Security Act, which is a lot easier to say. The piece behind this act is federal funding to financial aid for institutions of higher learning. So if you don't do what Clery Act says you have to do, then the threat is that you only need your we don't find that that happens all the time. The secondary impact that can be had is a fine, which is actually what you do see a lot. You've seen a lot of that in the Fenton aid and a lot of the other viruses where people have violated reporting. It's a very significant, I'm going to misquote myself. I don't, $35,000 is going up. So it started out at $27,500 per day per violation. It's now up to $35,000 a day per day per violation. So they can find you in violation of something that happened 10 years ago and theoretically fine you $35,000 per day since the time of that violation. We have to publish an annual security report every year, which we don't mind doing. Unfortunately, it makes us do things and report things that don't actually reflect directly on what the campus police does, per se. It combines brief policy statements, refers you out to policies that affect a lot of different things. It does give you good information on certain crime statistics. There are defined crime statistics in a minute, a bit. And it does talk about sexual violence and victim rights. It talks about disclosures that we have to make to the campus through emergency notification, which is different from a timely warning. So emergency notification is, somebody's outside our door right now, everybody's got a duck and cover, we'll tell you in 15 minutes if that's going to change. That would be an emergency notification. A timely warning is, last night we learned of a robbery, the person's still on the loose. It was over in College Town. Please be careful when you're going to this area. This is the methodology that the person used, so, you know, all the safety tips that come with the timely warnings. I'm sure all of you have been recipients of at least one of those so far. And then we published, again, we published crime law that shows all of the crimes that are committed on campus, and that has to be producible in a printed format within 48 hours of request. We publish ours. On request, we have the crime log that goes out every morning, absent Saturday morning and Sunday morning. Monday morning only, following afternoon, Saturday and Sunday.
They misdemeanors as well?
Yes, all the way down to violations, actually. All the way through. The violation felony, that is for the daily crime log. Yes. So when you go to our morning report, it also has to disclose crimes in other jurisdictions that we learn of that have an adjacent to the campus. So we're supposed to get statistics from the Compton County Sheriff's Office, Cedar Heights Department, as well as the other police department. We don't always get every statistic. We don't always get every report. So sometimes we overhear or we do a joint investigation or there are other things that cause us to come to that attention. Or someone might report initially to us. We find it's not in our jurisdiction and we refer it out to the other agency. Fine there. As I said, in 1990, and then the subsequent amendments, 92, 98, 2008, and then most recently in 2013, to connect with the Violence Against Women Act, the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, to say that. That is by far the most dramatic change that has come about. I do want to mention that it might be later in the presentation, I apologize, I kind of forgot, but Clery Act also covers the reports of fires on campus, so we partner with Environmental Health and Safety on their reports of incidents of fire on campus. There's also a subsection, which people don't really care that much about, around defrauding students through credit applications. So I get to see every year I have to sign off that I've audited all student credit vendors. And I'm like, oh, I'm not going to that. I could be on the office. Because we don't do that. But those are the types of things that fall out of the sack. It started off as an act for sexual violence, and then it got a lot of these tag on. And safety and security, the only one that doesn't really match well with that credit reporting one. Again, preparing that campus watch, that annual security report, collecting and publishing statistical information from campus security authorities. So not just what's reported to us, but if a report goes to a housing authority, someone in the residential programs, if there are low-level adjudications that happen within that, something goes to the judicial administrator's office, if a coach, there are a number of people on this campus that are designated as campus security authorities by their role to the campus. They don't get to say, oh, I'd like to be one. It's by the role they take. They get designated. If someone reports a crime to them, they must, by law, report it out statistically. Just a number saying, hey, I don't have any more information, but a student just came in today and said that they were sexually assaulted. I need you to know that. And then we have to hold it as a statistic. And then we make sure that our policies and procedures are in alignment with the federal requirements. And I now have a lot of help doing that because I have one two-thirds time employee that does that, and we have a liaison within council's office that helps us keep current with the changes that are going on there. So with theory, you also have to talk about geography. So you can't just look at a map. And I know there's a map circulating earlier. We were talking about campus lighting that seems to be been pulled from theory crimes. Find that. I don't know where that came from now. But basically, theory talks about on-campus residential facilities, so you might see a double count. As you look at a chart in there, you'll see a split. You can't add across the chart line. It's different designations. So whether it's on-campus is an academic building, it'll show up in the on-campus solo residential, but if it happens, that residential will be double shown in the next column. And then there's the non-campus. And that's something that's not owned by Cornell or controlled by Cornell, but is used for educational purposes. We lease property off campus, or if there's a common student-only gathering place. And sometimes we don't even know what definition it is. We have to call up to the Department of Education, here's a good facility, here's how it's being used, here's what it's being used for, where would you put that, and they help us guide. And then there's the public property, which is anything outside of us that is not outside of us. And it should be adjacent to the campus, but because an institution like Cornell and different pockets of properties all throughout the city of Indiana and the county and some kids in Portland, we have to be very careful about how we pull those things. So there's 10 major categories. This is a federal law, and there are different state definitions for each one of these. So we have to take these and break these down into what New York state law is actually following in some of these categories. Criminal homicide, sex offenses, forcible, non-forcible, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, which is why you see a lot of crime alerts in our area because we do see a lot of burglary, motor vehicle theft, arson, domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking. And the asterisks are the ones that are newly added. So imagine the position we're in, and we're in a sexual assault investigation, and we're trying to be very forensic about our interviewing and not being offensive to the victim and not being victim-blaming, but I have to ask. If it doesn't come up in our interview, I have to ask, oh, did you know the person? Oh, were they stalking you? You know, it causes a bit of a juxtaposition in our work that have to also comply with the theory regulations. Those are the crimes that are reported in the directly into the theory stats always, all the time. These will show up if they're directly related to a hate crime. So you'll additionally see those as an addendum underneath. Usually, if there's not even usually anything we're charting in our neighborhood, we have bias-related incidents, which is important to differentiate from bias crimes, which are state-defined and have certain parameters that must be met. And the district attorney actually decides whether or not a hate crime actually happened. We can forward the information, but that office is the one that determines whether or not it's actually a hate crime. But we have a lot of bias incidents on campus, so you might see some disparity here when you look at the statistics in your mind because you may know of a lot of ICE incidents, and yet there's no hate crime. Next slide. And these are the hate crimes are also very specific to the protected classes, and this is just a list of those protected classes. And you can see national origin and gender identity have been added as of 2013. We also have to report out on our arrests and referrals. A referral is actually an arrest in the statistical world of the state as well as federal. So if someone was referred to the judicial administrator, if it is a corresponding state law that we could have charged them with, that statistically shows up as a tick mark in these columns. So they want us to specifically report out drug violations, which include marijuana, liquor law violations, which we have a lot of, and illegal weapons possessions, which thankfully we don't have that many of, but we do have them on the campus. So here's how we get our statistics. People come to us directly. We are by law required to inquire of other agencies off campus, and currently we have State Police, Cuba Heights, Tompkins County, and the Ithaca Police Department that we send out an annual letter to. They are under no obligation in this federal legislation to report back to us statistics. So we can ask, but they don't have to tell. Most of them are very cooperative with us. It's usually a matter of staffing and whether or not they have the opportunity to gather that information. The judicial administrator is one of those campus security authorities, and then we also do pull the tick marks that are appropriately aligned with the types of categories that I listed before from workforce and inclusion. And again, we don't know, so we're protecting the confidentiality of people who don't want to report to the police. We are collecting a tick mark. This happened. This is the category in which it happened. We have no details except for if we can discern if it's campus, non-campus, public property, or the other one is residential. Next. And as I mentioned, there's a deadline by which we have to publish the annual security report. So the 2013 report, the one that the statistics end in December of 2013, has to be out by October of 2014. We always get ours out before the freshmen come on campus. So we always get ours out in August. It arrives before the students arrive. That's our goal. So we always need that. We use the statistical data ourselves for looking at where we want to deploy people, what crime areas, if we have a lighting problem, and those types of things. We also report to teacher staff. They want to know what's going on. We use the data for that. And anytime anybody makes an inquiry, hey, I hear Tuesday is a bad day to drive on campus because of the last tickets written. I'd like to know. You can ask me the question. I'll try to find out for you. I might need a little time for that one. But. So now we get into this pretty mess. So I know that, Matthew, there was a map that we were talking about from a lighting survey for a different purpose. What that prompted me to do is go back and try to recreate what we thought that map was doing. So there's a map circulating around lighting survey saying we have a condition of lighting that we're concerned about because of crimes, just off campus as well as some areas on campus. But the map that we had was actually pulled from limited data. It was pulled only from the time, I figured this out, it's from the timely warnings that we issued in a one-year time frame. So we thought it was 10 years of data pulled by somebody, but actually what it was 1 year's worth of data, and it was only crime alerts. So I had my staff view, and I now have a crime analyst. Because I had put out a heat map, and the darker the red, the more incidents we have. This is all the serious reportable crimes put on a crime map of Cornell University 2011 to 2013. All right? So you can see where our hot spots are. Criminally, we're looking at a hot spot up around Jessup Road, Howard Newton. Those are some areas where we've had some problems. And then we'll get to some more breakdowns a little bit. Not too dry. And then, of course, the College Town-ish area down in the area of high alcohol consumption. And then you'll just see various spots here and there. Let's go to the next slide so we can break up some of the data so we can help. And I will tell you, these reports are wonderful for a first blush, oh, I'd like a little bit of information. These reports do not allow, the federal law does not actually allow us to go back in and pull a statistic out if we can unequivocally say that that report is false. Okay, we don't have to put it in if on its face we don't think it's true, because we have enough information to disprove that. But if we don't have enough information to prove or disprove, and it doesn't require guilty or not guilty, just did it happen, then we can't pull that data. It stays in there. So if someone falsely reports a crime that says that their watch was stolen from their dorm while they were asleep, that's a burglar. When we reached in their dwelling, they took their stuff, they performed a theft, and they left. Well, if you find out later that they just really wanted the insurance money from the Rolex, and it's not really a crime, that stat still stays there. I can't pull it out. So they're a great first blush, but they are not the end-all be-all, and I will be happy to help you with statistics that actually mean something to you for your question at any time that you want. They do give a good overview of most universities in the way that I would say that if you see more kind of crime reported in a campus that you're considering for your offspring to attend, I would be happy to send my student to that one as opposed to one who has very little crime reported. Because that usually means one of two things. They're not following the federal guidelines. They live in utopia and you should just move there. Or they just don't feel like putting out statistics. Our statistics you see will vary. The crime totals you see an increase. But you can see the numbers are very small, 5, 10, 50. My breakouts are very small for the number of crimes that we see reported. We did see a spike in reporting of sex offenses, forcible sex offenses, back in 2012. Now, normally when you see a spike like that, what you'll find is you have one or a very small group of perpetrators that you're looking for. Once you get those people, those stats fall right off. And that was the case in that particular time frame. Burglary, I think people are just reporting more to us, to tell you the truth. I think people are realizing that we can do something about it, so they're bringing us more information. Let's go to the next one.
You can include all of it.
No, these are only Cornell.
Okay.
So the ones I'm showing you are the ones that are reported directly to Cornell Police. So I haven't even put in the ones that are reported to the other campus. So if someone reported something that didn't come to our offices through residential programs, or they went to the JA directly and there was no need to contact us, those wouldn't be reported. You know, the IRS are slowly declining. Now my numbers are a little bit larger. Might have been law violations. Put all those in place. But largely referrals, right? The majority, our intent is to have an impact on our community for educational purposes. And that's why there are very few actual arrests and mostly referrals. We want to get people in programs that help them understand what their issues are with alcohol consumption. Same thing with drug law violations. And I will tell you, that green spike there in 2013, that's the legalization of marijuana in other states. People coming from those states, coming here and going, I'm smoking anyway. This is my civil disobedience. It's legal over here. Why shouldn't it be legal over there? So it's just more out in the open. It's still illegal in New York. We still have to respond to it because we get complaints about it. But I think we can explain that spike pretty readily in fact. You can see an increase in weapons possession and a very small weapons arrest as well. Again, these are, don't have the details of why those are exactly. But I do know that we see an increase in crime, we see an increase in violence. So these statistics are the ones that are reported by other campus security authorities. And they two do not overlap. I can't, so if the city gets the same report that I do, we find out whose jurisdiction it's in and it regards them when it starts. There's no overlap in those. And you can see the sex offenses is forcible. Are all over the place too, and a much higher number outside. And that could be, yes, ma'am.
So you say that these two don't overlap? Do you not combine? You could either not.
No, they're not combined.
Right.
Right, they're just
separate. They're combined.
We don't combine them. You can combine them by making doing the addition in the chart by the same categories, because they're split into the same categories. I'm trying to remember the chart, but I don't think we have a combined total. We can do that. There are different issues with doing that. These aren't necessarily from other police agencies. They might be from, again, residential programs with the judicial administrator, varying levels of reliability of information. They might come through victim services. They might come through a number of different ways. But these numbers tend to be less verified than when it comes to agency. That's the only reason why we're trying to keep it separate. And as you can see, people will be much more inclined to report outside the police still. But we are seeing those numbers get closer together. That they would continue, they have built faith in our systems and trying to report more and more sexual offenses to us as well as to authorities that are taking our lives. And burglary, robbery, the domestic violence and stalking, these things definitely happen on campus, and it's very clear that they do. So here's the liquor law violations. What you're going to get, these are not redundant numbers. These are numbers that are coming to us through counting. So in addition to what we've issued out, these referrals are also being issued out through, largely through residential programs, sometimes through the degree system. Drug law violations are much less. We see more of those than with arrests would have been something that we probably were on site with another police agency, so we knew about it. We have that system. We don't have a housing authority arrest program. The hate crime reporting in 2013, we had one on-campus criminal mischief that was characterized by race, one by sexual orientation, one non-campus aggravated assault characterized by sexual orientation. So the non-campus one, I recall being someone who was in college camp being punched, and that was based on a person's disease, gender identity, sexual orientation. And the other two were both for BDs, but they met the definition of a hate crime. And then 2012, we had another report of hate crimes, and then we had one public property.
We dealt heavily with, and had the folks come in on diversity because of the incident, I believe it was a Greek incident, you know, was really ugly racially, and caused all of some sit down and protests. How was that classified under Cliff?
It wasn't a hate crime because the district attorney determined that it wasn't meeting the New York State statute. So that was not listed as a hate crime. And I can explain a lot more on that one. I know that there was a lot of perception that was a hate crime, but the actual incidents and the actions taken and the impetus for those actions were not based on race. They became about race later on, but the crimes themselves were not based on race. We have that a lot. A couple of the sexual assaults that were reported, they were not reported in here. There's a couple crimes that we put out timely warnings on back in 2012, I think it was, 2011, 2012, where they were sexual offenses, but in my mind, they're the dog crimes. A woman was grabbed around the neck and somebody tried to drag her off into the woods. Okay, why would that be? You know, there's no interest in the wallet, there's no interest in the money. Sitting here at the table, we can all say that was a premeditated attempt at a sexual assault. The New York State law won't allow us to go there absent information that, you know, there was no whispering in the ear, there was no yelling out that I have an intent to, there was no touching of intimate parts. Nothing I could apply in the law would put that in the letter of the law. I can try to appeal to the sensibilities of people and put that in the color of the law, and misdemeanor for the offense, but long and short of it is I have unlawful imprisonment, maybe, and harassment at best. But we put it out because we knew that there was a problem with that. And sometimes you just can't take it over the line of New York State law. So that would be an example of why you can't go that way. We have to go by what New York State law says. And these are the reported by other campus security authorities. So again, this would include the advised incident reporting system that doesn't come to us, as well as judicial administrators, as well as student housing. And you can see there's still a great decline from 2012, less than half. But overall, I would say these are still in the unreported category. These people aren't bringing them to the attention that they need to be brought. So it's still important that we see both in this category and in the sexual assaults in particular are places where I'm interested in seeing an increase because I think they're underreported. So, questions? Yes.
Sure. So for the statistics for you have things that are coming from outside sources, I know working with residents of the program, we submit stuff on our own, but then we often call your office as well to have that put in. So mm-hmm. Does it get double reported?
No, we screen.
Which screen is it leaning in your data? Like,
if it becomes a police report, it goes into the police report category.
Okay.
If it never becomes a police report, it stays in the report by the other campus. That's a way of not allowing institutions to gloss over reports. But because, well, the police don't have any information, so it's not always the best way.
I was just wondering, the institutions you said that they report, so I'm trying to figure out if it's a good place for people to complain about things that happened off campus. Does that reflect at all?
That would be in the other campus security authority, other law enforcement agencies, and the other campus security authorities. So that will come to us if A, they give it to us,
mm-hmm.
or B, we help them investigate it, or C, we learn of it because we've overheard it, or we joint investigated it.
Does it have to be campus security?
It only has to involve a student because of the property designation. So you've got your on-campus residents, on-campus, non-campus, which is still has Cornell control. So for instance, I know when the architecture school is being redesigned, they shunted everybody down to SC3. And that whole facility was filled with students. And we had a lot of conversations about how safe it was to get from point A to point B, and they designed some shuttle systems, and they did a whole bunch of things around it. We didn't own that building. We certainly were using it for educational purposes, and those were areas where we had to monitor more crime statistics than we normally would have. But the case that you described, if it wasn't a campus property or an on-campus property, it was a public property, and it would show up in that public.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on the statistics that you showed. There is a huge increase, it looks like, in alcohol-related events, or
is the alcohol violations with the law violations?
Yeah.
Actually, it's a declination.
What's that?
It declined from, it's bigger than the other categories?
No, it looks like just in the trend of the years, it looks quite substantially higher than the 2 years.
Well, there's no law violations, but not the length of law. Let's go back to that one.
I'm just wondering if I maybe...
I want to make sure I get the right chart up to the hour. I think I'm looking at the right one. The Cornell Police, reported to Cornell Police statistics about...
This one right here.
This one right here?
Yep.
That's off-campus. So the off-campus could be any one of a number of things. I have no way of breaking that down to say this many were from the police, this many were from housing, this many were for something else.
Sure.
So it could just be that in 2013... That was the year that IT got it together to actually see some statistics.
Oh, I see.
So
and it's not related to the one above, which are yours.
Ours is more consistent year to year.
So there's nothing we can attribute that increase that you would.
Not directly, without going through a big analysis.
Okay.
And trying to break down that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Gina asked one of my questions, but what is a non-forcible sex offense? And I've had so many of my constituents and students come to me with, you know, I had a burglary in College Town, or I had someone in my room who I didn't know in College Town. What steps should I suggest to students that come to me with?
In all the cases, so let me answer your last one first. So when anybody has anything that they feel uncomfortable about, unsafe about, they should call 911 if there is immediate action of that happening. Someone's in your room, you come into your house, and you don't know who is there, you know, back out and call 911. No doubt about it. If it's an after the fact, you can call the non-emergency number. If you don't have it for the jurisdiction, or you don't know what jurisdiction you're in, you can call us on the non-emergency line, 255-1111, we'll get you connected with the right authorities. But we want people to report, because a lot of times, usually in those scenarios, you've got someone who's over-intoxicated, who's just made a mistake, they're in the wrong place, or you've got someone who with a serial issue that we want to get hands on the person. And we don't know that that person has a serial issue until we find out that they've been in multiple places. So without the reports, there's very little we can do about it.
Question for Chief Zone?
She had another
non-forcible sexual offense. What constitutes
non-forcible is usually goes in that, so remember when they were talking about that consensual unwelcome. It falls into that category of there might be people who are engaged in sexual acts that they are consensual about, but it morphs into something that is non-consensual, unwanted, unwelcome, and I think that's the problem with how do you define that. So forcible is usually referred for acts of violent force, pinning down, holding back, that act that I described earlier about grabbing somebody and dragging them off to some other location. That's what that forcible usually means. The non-forcible usually comes in at a much lower level, and the parties often, but not always, know each other, and there is a lack of clarity on whether or not consent is.
So just to clarify, we haven't had a single case reported in the past 3 years, 2011 to 2013.
For non-forcible
sexual offenses.
Right.
So not a single case.
Not for the police.
Wow.
And it doesn't mean that they haven't happened. I think that that we have changed our viewpoint of the use of force. So I think the police themselves have readjusted their sights. It doesn't have to be violent. That there is a lot of verbal forcing that people coercion that people do that is now more inclusive. And so that might have bumped the statistic over into the forcible category, whereas in the past you might have seen it in the non-forcible category.
Okay.
But I think we have expanded our definition of our own interpretation of consent, absent having one to go off of. So if you've got someone who's involved in an intimate act, and there is a clear delineation, but not violent interference in the past, and I would say that one past, you could see that showing up in a different way.
Okay. Chief Zoner, thank you, as always, for coming. I'm sure there may still be some questions out there. Please get them to Randy Wayne, who will get them to Chief Zoner, and we'll get them answered. Thank you very much, as always, for coming to visit with us and keep us up to date. Next, I need to turn to a discussion with members on divestment of fossil fuels. Professor Hatch.
Yeah, to cut to the chase, I know we're running tight on time. At the Sustainable Summit that mentioned we had attended, there was a lot of strong discussion about the essentia, which is the getting our carbon level down at the university, but it was embedded in the larger picture of the present climate period. I know that the two issues were linked of making the carbon to that carbon neutral date come back to 2035 from 2050, and the divestment issue, and that the University Assembly chose to vote against requesting a divestment, against the fully divestment, in spite of the fact that other assemblies and the faculty senate had voted for it. And I know some of the reasons that were given at that, and I brought some publications I was prepared to read out of question whether the assumptions that and arguments that were raised contrary to having a resolution on divestment passed were actually well thought through. There's been lots of examination of the issue, both by other college campuses and also by economists about the profitability and the effects on investments of investment portfolios of divestment, and questioning whether, in fact, there is such a great effect. There's more of a risk to keeping the fossil fuel companies in your portfolio, some people have shown. I won't read those or get into the proof of it. I would simply ask the Assembly to request or instruct the Campus Infrastructure Committee to revisit the issue of Cornell divestment from fossil fuel companies. And if the Campus Infrastructure Committee as a whole is too busy with other matters or is uninterested, to form a subcommittee with the assistance of the executive committee for the University Assembly, an ad hoc subcommittee to discuss and recommend to our assembly some kind of action concerning the divestment of fossil fuels.
So I heard a pending motion. Is that a motion you want to make tonight, or do you want to submit some materials and put that on a referendum for our January 27th meeting where you can perhaps...
No, it's not a motion. It's actually... I'm asking for the assembly to request, which is not a motion. I don't want to move that one of our committees do something, because I don't think that's necessary. At the outset of the committee of the assembly, when you were giving out tasks mm-hmm. to the various, you didn't ask for us all to agree to those specific tasks. You just came.
Well, we did. At the end, we voted on to refer all those to committee. But I mean, in other words, you are, of course, at any time free to bring forth the resolution calling for divestment. Ned LaSalle isn't there.
I want to turn it to the infrastructure committee to reconsider, because I know from discussions with members of the infrastructure committee that when the issue of revisiting was brought up, people were suggesting that it was an issue that was dealt with already. And I'm suggesting that, you know, new information may be forthcoming, new points of view may be forthcoming, and I think it's incumbent on the Assembly to request, I'm asking the Assembly, to request that they reconsider this issue in full, and if they are too busy or not interested as a body, that they, together with the executive committee, and this is a request, not a resolution.
Okay, well, very well. I will refer the issue to for consideration for the CIC, and we'll see what they report back to us.
No, I actually would like the assembly to. That's why I brought.
Well, then you are making a motion to formally refer the issue to the CIC for their consideration.
I think the motion is right. Maybe not a resolution.
Please.
So on the Campus Infrastructure Committee, Professor Robert Howarth, me, and one other student, Alex Dow, are all working on divestment at least a little bit. We had meetings at the beginning of the semester, and we hope to continue them. So I hope that if you are interested in pushing this topic forward, that you would help us and get involved in what we're doing. But it is... I think, like, contrary to what you think, it is an issue that we are looking into on the Campus Infrastructure Committee.
Yes, I guess I've had reports
from a colleague that the discussion at a certain point was, it was suggested that it was an issue that was already dealt with in the past. And although there may be individuals on the committee who are interested, it's not a committee. The committee as a whole is not invested in doing something.
I would.
Go ahead, please.
I'm actually surprised that that was reported because I'm also part of the IHS.
Oh, terrific.
Because in our priority list, we had a set of things that we wanted to get to, we wanted to engage with, and we were going to do it. After our immediate concern of TCAT fundraising, this was number two on that list. And we talked about it, there's been a lot of conversation around it, about, yes, even though we've heard specific rebuttals from the squadron, why he might, he thinks this might not be, or why he wasn't about, why, whatever the reasons were for not going through with it, that the company should still focus on keeping up the effort and trying to push that effort.
That's terrific. I'll take your invitation and I'll be there.
So let me just circle the a couple of points. Professor Ngrafia was the guest speaker at the summit. He made a very compelling presentation. He is clearly an expert on this issue, all aspects of this issue, and he said he did not understand why the university, even despite the financial things, would not seriously consider divestment on this issue, and he had a lot to, he didn't go into it, but he promised he would if anybody invited him to do so. It is currently an issue the CIC is taking up. The difference between what you're proposing and what they're doing is what you're proposing would require them to give us some sort of an answer. They may choose to do it anyway, which is certainly within their purview, and they are looking at it. But if we refer it and say we want an answer back, then we are tasking them to do it and give us an answer, whatever it may be.
Well, thank you for your prompting. What I suggest then to the members is, would you find it useful for us to request that there be some kind of determination by, let's say, the second meeting of the assembly in the spring term? By February, in other words, that there be a resolution of some sort or some kind of explanation of why there isn't one. Mm-hmm. By that, would you find that useful in your efforts?
I actually think it would be useful. So the student assembly is going to see a resolution this week on divestment. So it would be like a progression of like what the students are doing. I also think that having a deadline would force it to become like a priority on our list, but I don't know if other people from the campus research committee have opinions on that.
Deja, sorry. Forgive me, I do that consistently.
Yeah,
I apologize.
That's all right. I actually disagree. I think we're going to take it up anyway. I think that's like going to be our next meeting is probably going to be all about that. I don't think requesting would expedite it because we're doing it pretty much.
Well,
I think we're going to do it anyway. So
this is just a matter of if someone reported to you that nothing is going on, but the committee says a lot is going on, so I guess.
No. The person who reported to me is on the committee.
Oh.
So I'm suggesting it wasn't nothing that was going on. It was, in fact, that there was a, it was slow.
All right, so let me communicate with the chair of the CIC. He's not here now. I'll convey an expectation that we want to hear back from this. We'll target the February meeting. Let me see what his response is, and we have time to pick this up formally between now and our next meeting and at our next meeting as well. I've seen enough interest. I don't know where it sways, but we went through a lot of effort last year to get something forward, and we had a lot of testimony on it. This is a little different nuance, and it definitely seems to be enough interest to revisit it that we'll make sure it's on their agenda. And if that's satisfactory to you, then let me move on to the last item of the evening. We'll with your unanimous consent, if we can extend for 5 more minutes, and we'll cut out the reports of the assemblies unless one of the assembly members has something vital that they need to impart to us. Can I have your unanimous consent to extend for 5 minutes?
I just wanted to say, regarding any questions that you might want me to take to the CSCC, just send them to RCA7 with the subject line CSCC, and that way, because our meeting is Thursday.
So be timely. Be timely. Then the final agenda that we'll cover tonight, President Skorton has referred to us, and this was in your placard when you came into the room, a request for the assembly to take up making Cornell a no-smoking campus. Current policy is no smoking within 25 feet of campus buildings. The UA took this up 2-3 years ago. They thought that the current smoking policy, you know, while they were all for the health benefits, they were not willing to impose a campus-free environment. We also learned at that time that their costs in signage and enforcement and even questions about actually enforceability. I wanted to make sure we had Chief Zoner here briefly to, if she wanted to say something about that. That issue came up through a member-led resolution. It was voted down. This has been referred to us by the president of the university. We must look into it, therefore. We don't have to necessarily change our answer unless that's what we feel. The question I have for you, and I don't expect an answer tonight in the time that we have, is do we want to task the our constituent assemblies to come back with, do they support this initiative? We are not being asked to write the policy. We're being asked, do we support it? So if we do, the resolution would say, we've canvassed X, we've polled Y, we believe the campus should be, smoke-free, and encourage you to take that up at the administrative levels and make it so. You know, I don't know. Not to actually solve how it would happen and how miserable it would make Kathy Zoner's life or other fallout. But again, 2 or 3 years ago, which generationally is a long time on a campus, the view was, you know, the trades smoke. I know the employee assembly has a level of concern because, you know, there are certain groups that do smoke. They smoke compliance with Cornell policy, but making it smoke free would be, in their view, a hostile thing, even though it's for their good. So it's really a question of, do you want to take it up, and how do we want to approach it? This is one that I don't see this CWC tackling directly. I would probably recommend to you that we refer it to the constituent assemblies and tell me what your constituents think on the matter. Do your constituencies support it? And report back to us in that fashion. And I had talked to the Office of the Assemblies about, what's our ability to actually put a 1 or 2 question survey out? Do you support it or not? And see kind of what the raw numbers are. 50-50, 80-20, it's a data point. It won't be unanimous. We all know that. And Professor Wayne.
I think the CJC would be happy to take this up, provided we can include broccoli.
I'm going to edit that too. Oh, Randy Wayne to volunteer. Ma'am.
This is something that a couple of the members of the SA have been looking into for a long time. We haven't made a ton of progress, and so we've done a little bit of like informal polling, I would say. But it's something we're already working on, so if you're going to charge us with it, it would be okay.
Well, I'd like to come to a decision with this. We have Dr. Corson Riker currently at our January meeting. There's another voice we'd like to hear from. I'll give Chief Zoner a minute if she would like to say what she thinks on or off the record.
We actually already have enforceability issues with the 25-foot rule because it's not a crime, so it's not really a police matter. It's an HR policy matter, and it's not one that's very easy to navigate. And it also goes along towards addictions and disabilities. So those are the things, I think, that are commonly raised in conversation.
There is also a cost of enforcement, signage, but on the flip side, I would tell you, SUNY Cortland has gone smoke-free, and President Skorton
before he came here, University of Ohio, he made them smoke
Ohio.
Iowa. Not Ohio, my bad. Made them smoke free. So, you know, it has and can be done. Professor Booker.
But you're absolutely right. This is an HR issue, and it has immense impact in terms of what the institution, how the institution actually addresses issues of health. And when you talk about the science issue, if you smoke and you're a Cornell employee, you're actually causing, you know, in terms of financial harm, way more than science. And that's so in most cases, these rules, which are actually very common in the corporate world, aren't about whether or not people are happy or unhappy or breaking the rule. It's about giving a message that this is, it's an issue of wellness.
Correct.
So I think
correct.
It's
also an issue of civil liberties. And
it's just like we've had in many discussions, you always have the right to disobey any rule. And everybody has
and pay the consequences. Yes.
You just have to deal with the consequences. So you always have the right to disobey any rule.
All right. With that, I'm going to put those up in a more meaningful way in our January 27th meeting, which is the next time we meet as the full body, and put some intellectual effort into how we might approach this in a responsible way to get an answer back to President Skorton before the end of term. Are there any pressing matters that we still need to address?
This demonstrates that Skorton's a smart guy. He's already done this once, and he's actually taken a very interesting approach to try to do it.
Motion to adjourn.
Then, by unanimous consent, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.